Welcome to the Retail Focus Podcast, a weekly collection of news, interviews, and information from the world of retail. Here are your hosts, Trent Kling and Leighton Kling.
Welcome to this edition of the Retail Focus Podcast with Trent Kling and Leighton Kling. Coming up on today's show, Domino's, they're doing some work on public infrastructure. We'll get to that in our last segment. Dave & Buster's beat on earnings. They also announced a new CEO. And we'll talk about Lidl. They've been out of the news for a while up until this week. We'll not only talk about a lawsuit they're embroiled in, but also how their expansion plans may not be as robust as initially reported. Reach out to us on Instagram and Twitter for the latest news and interesting retail-related pictures as well. You can find us at Retail Podcast in both of those mediums. And we would, as always, really appreciate it if you took a second to subscribe and or rate us wherever you listen. So we begin today's show with Restoration Hardware, or RH as it's now known, as the upscale home furnishings retailer reported after market close on Monday. Shares are up 220% since last August. This despite the fact that the company has been criticized for their different strategies to boost traffic and repeat sales, including discounting. Now, RH posted net income this quarter of $28.1 million. This is good because it's versus a loss last year of $3.4 million. Let's keep in mind, though, where their share price is, where their market cap is. This is still pretty slight, just $21.8 million on the net income front. Adjusted earnings per share of $1.33 was an increase of a whopping 256%. Wall Street, in fact, expected 31 cents less. So the good here, Leighton, they beat analyst expectations. The bad is they still have a long way to go to make good on where their share price is currently sitting.
It's going to be hard for us to transition, as we're used to saying Restoration Hardware. It's now RH, but their website is still restorationhardware.com. So a lot of people still may be confused about that brand transition. I think it was a good move, but RH still has to stand for something. Overall, it's a company we've been following closely over the last year and a half, 2 years. And for the stock being up so much after earnings, you would think they would be on every key number we talk about on this podcast for their fiscal first quarter. However, revenue came in below expectations versus the increase in net income, as Trent had talked about. They brought in $557 million in revenue versus the $563 million that Wall Street was expecting. This was a net 1% decrease over 2017's figures as well, thanks to a transitionary period that the retailer is going through. And a lot of adjustment from upper management. They're trying to find their ground, trying to find traction. And because of that strategic overlay, the revenue is down a bit. And thanks to what they called full price success and lower outlet store related sales, adjusted gross margins did, however, increase 750 basis points to a first quarter record of 38% of sales. So this is a bright spot for us and something that a lot of the headlines were missing here, and that gross margins were a dismal 30% this time last year. So it's an astounding pickup for a company that really, like I said, has been going through some changes fundamentally. Management did raise full year guidance to an adjusted earnings per share mark of $6.34 to $6.83 per share versus prior outlook of $5.45 to around $6.20 per share. If we go through the notes, we see that management gave an open letter on their website, their investor relations website, to shareholders and analysts before the call. So the entirety of their remarks on the formal earnings call was based on questions from analysts, with a somewhat large group of 10 analysts coming forth on the call and listening to what management had to say as they were responding to some of these insightful questions. Overall, they said that this latest quarter was unique in that a lot of their proprietary product offerings have been identified as helping to boost margins. Again, this has to do with their full price assortment. They're not discounting as much, and this is what Trent had alluded to in opening this story. They are confident that they can keep the right assortment and an elevated brand going forward. It is all about the buying side. We talked about this last week with discount retailers such as Ollie's Bargain Outlet, in that the supply chain is extremely important from the fundamentals of trying to buy at the right price, but also the right assortment. And it looks as though RH is doing just that. They expect to get 40% gross margin, so an uptick from that current mark of 38%, or at least close to that 40% gross margin mark in the long run on the strength of the aforementioned items and what they call revolutionary physical retailing. And that is what we would classify them as. If you go to their website, again, restorationhardware.com, you can see that they're taking a different approach than some of their competition, namely Wayfair and other retailers, even though those retailers are not going to be classified as upscale, not going to have the price points that Restoration Hardware or RH does. Granted, they are doing a really good job at merchandising in their physical stores as well, their showrooms. They're getting a lot of customer engagement there, and I think that is a differentiator for the company. Along with that confidence, they are seeing the membership model having some staying power. As long as they factor in membership discounts into list prices, they should be fine there as far as the all-important repeat business, not hurting gross margins. They are looking at their membership program as more of a promotional tool, wherein they see the power of advertising new products and events really tailored towards their best loyal customers. Management went into detail about their mindset and how they're building out a large membership model. And they said this has really been developed to streamline operations, to lower the amount of time that they had to give to the one-off sales that they had so much of in previous runs. This, in turn, has given management time to innovate and focus on what they do best, their core competencies, which would be merchandising and on the buying side, buying the right products that are innovative, trending, and so forth. And so rather than trying to manage all of the inventory fluctuations thanks to those one-time sales, they can now focus their day-to-day operations as more of a high-scale retailer that is focused on their core customer base. In-store personnel related to that are not going to be inundated with customers all at once when they have those timely weekend sales, which allows them, again, to spend more quality time now on average per customer. Very important in their business as they basically act now as an interior design group. And in that vein, they did mention quite candidly, in fact, that they are turning into a serious interior design business. Companies like Haverty's have long had staff on hand to visit homes and businesses, but having everyone in RH on board with this idea of personalization could be beneficial for the brand long term. And we think that is probably the best strategic direction because they do operate in a niche market. Obviously, your market's going to be capped by income levels, so I think they are doing the right thing here as far as their long-term vision is concerned.
I'm still a little bit concerned, though, because if you were on the call or if you were one of the analysts on the call, management pushed back at some analyst questions, in particular the way they look at customer data. Now, management said on the call that if they get the fundamentals of their business aligned and stay focused, the good performance will take care of itself. But analysts wanted to know, in particular, what data has stood out to them. And management said some retailers are too dependent on data. Basically, when you see answers like this, remember a few years ago, Eddie Lampert, several years ago at this point now, that said retailers are too dependent on data when he was on earnings calls for Sears Holdings. Oftentimes, when you push back on a question like that, that means there might be some underlying data that's not great. And in this case, RH cited companies that always mention certain data on their conference calls, yet have a decade of stagnant sales. And we've talked about Pier One, perhaps, being one of those companies. Still, you know, if you're succeeding someplace, and obviously here they beat on net income, there has to be some data or something somewhere that they are excited about. And it's odd in this day and age when we're talking about unlocking the strengths that are within your data, and we'll talk about this in our last story here today, finding things in your data that can maybe help you be a better company. For them to just say, you know, hey, we don't really have any data that we look at, is either kind of an untruth, or it may be cause for concern going forward, especially when we know their competitors are using data very heavily. Now, some of the things that they're excited about overall, not necessarily micro data, but they are excited about store comps, or as they call their stores, gallery comps. For the second quarter through the fourth quarter, they're expecting mid-single digits from physical galleries, a huge change from a couple of years ago, especially the 2016 campaign where they struggled so much to keep things in stock and deliver a quick turnaround to their customer base. Within the physical locations, they're bullish on pushing their membership model, which is something Leighton talked about. It's something that helped to spur a turnaround after that rough 2016. they hope to proportionately add new members. Some of their new customers are going to be buyers from the hospitality industry as well. Is that something RH has been doing? They've been reaching out to the hospitality industry for some corporate contracts and that particular line of business. This is also something that we don't talk about it a whole lot, but JCPenney and other interior design firms, or firms that have interior design capabilities within them, have been doing a lot of lately. They think that in the future, RH does, the showrooms can get 30% of their sales through hospitality buys overall. Upscale hotels looking to buy things like room sets, and so far the response has been positive, but it's not just necessarily the room sets. Sometimes it can be fragmented a little bit, for example, window decorations or a certain facet that you want in every room. But we have seen growth certainly in the hospitality industry. We see new hotels obviously popping up all over the place, certainly at a quicker rate than the old hotels are getting demolished. And this is something that might be able to add to their business model. I think this is actually possibly the one thing across Restoration Hardware, or RH, that we're actually fairly bullish on. And Leighton, between a less promotionally intensive business model and catering more towards contract work or the hospitality industry, they're looking to save on inventory because they don't need pieces of furniture waiting around as much or in the showrooms quite as much. They feel like $300 to $400 million less in inventory might be needed in the future than would have otherwise been needed had they not shifted their business model. Still, you bristle whenever Restoration Hardware talks about cutting down on inventory because, again, that's what got them in the hole in the first place back in 2015 and 2016.
You make a good point, Trent, but management made a good point as well in noting that all of those predictions, all of those sales predictions that were centered around the weekend promotions, they really don't have to stock their showrooms full of furniture anymore, or at least their distributorships. I think this is going to be a good strategy for them, and this is certainly something that the shareholders appreciated along with their overall strategic vision. Shares were up over 35% at some points on Tuesday of this week in trading. Shares traded over $164 a share, and to keep this in perspective, on Monday, just before the earnings announcement, shares were trading around $118 a share, again, up significantly for the year. The last 5 years, though, up and down for the company. This is a company that has been around not too long. It's only been publicly traded for about 4.5 years, but you see that RH is a company still growing, at least in terms of the amount of showrooms they plan to build out and the amount of revenue they project out into 2019. Well, we move on with Lidl, as they are once again in the news because of a lawsuit, this time because of allegedly reneging on a real estate deal. This story comes to us via Spectrum News reporter Tim Spears. And Lidl has started to open locations along the East Coast, as we've been talking about for nearly 1.5 years now, but they've had some solidified plans in place to come to the U.S. for quite some time. To put this in perspective, they actually had purchase agreements to buy parcels of land and to make good on some development as early as in 2015. So a lot of local developers were getting excited, and everything was in place, the necessary processes to make way for proper infrastructure. According to sources, in the first few months of last year, things started to unfold in a not so positive way. Lidl started to feel like maybe they were biting off more than they could chew, as expansion plans were not meeting their original goals. And it's funny because Trent and I were talking before recording this podcast about how much positive energy was in the news from the plans that Lidl had outlined for the East Coast. Everyone was saying that Kroger and everybody else, every major grocery store operator, should be worried because they plan to take major market share for the states that they had planned to enter. You fast forward now, it appears to not be the case, and we'll get into some of those details here in a little bit. But in fact, the company had nearly 400 sites under contract or in process through letters of intent by early 2017. So because of this news, I think a lot of media outlets were saying that, well, the sheer amount of stores that they had planned to be opening was significant and could potentially take market share from the local grocers. It was in the spring of 2017 on the podcast when we talked about their plans to open nearly 150 stores along the East Coast over the next couple of years into 2019. This means that not even Lidl had true intentions of immediately at least opening or developing 400 new sites. So they had apparently planned a little too much in a short amount of time between 2015 and 2016 Despite recent slowing down, news releases still made it seem like the company would at least make it close to 100 locations by August of this year. Yet, we see now that the company only has 53 stores that are running. So as of mid-June, the company has nearly half of what they had originally proposed. All of this means that developers and landowners alike have been expecting Lidl to follow through and perform per the different contracts they had previously signed, like I said, 1 to 2 years ago. And while Lidl has allegedly backed out of developments in several states, there is one lawsuit that has hit our radar coming by way of North Carolina.
This lawsuit was filed on June 8th and claims that developers relied on false promises from Lidl and invested substantial funds into projects that Lidl knew would never come to fruition. The claims go a bit further, in fact, in saying that Lidl was either overly ambitious and gambling or was grossly negligent. Either way, not a good look for the German-owned grocer. So why have things not panned out? After all, I'm sure if you are familiar with retail, if you're in the retail industry, you probably saw the same headlines that we did 1 year ago about Lidl taking over the world and Lidl causing Kroger to shake in their boots. But fast forward to today, and according to business consultant Oliver Wyman, sales are only now picking up in terms of average basket size and overall traffic. And if we flip the script a little bit and we look a few years ago at Walmart's foray into Germany, there was perhaps little done as far as researching the culture and understanding how to market the new entrants, and so that was slow to take hold. And here we have kind of the same thing potentially going on. Now, it could be a matter of marketing. It could also be a matter of customers not making Lidl a habit. Maybe it's an interesting experience once or twice, but it's not becoming habitual. At least that's based on the numbers and the things that we've seen from analysts and consultants. And as Wyman stated, only now, a year after some of these locations moved in, are sales truly beginning to pick up. And furthermore, it's become obvious that Lidl executives perhaps got a bit lazy when researching target areas. You know, Leighton and I, we've talked with retailers a lot over the past few years about researching market areas, figuring out what makes for a good market and what doesn't. And some close to the situation are alleging that actually executives would sometimes rely almost solely on Google Earth for site targets. Now, surely there was some other things that went in there, but again, even if you're a large company, you need to have someone making site visits from that upper management, from that upper crust, to be helping along with making these decisions. You can look at Google Earth all day, but it's not going to tell you the best locations to move into, especially when you occupy the grocery space, which can be very, very tricky in terms of picking out a positive location. So Lidl here with their 53 locations, they've got about 2.5 times more products than their conventional European stores. So there is also a difference between the US stores and the European stores. This is something that's proven out a learning curve as well. Distribution is going to be harder if you have that many more SKUs, especially with the type of selection and quality, that's key, as they were aiming to have. And as one analyst put it, you can't try to outdo Aldi with service, which is fairly easy to do, have a higher quality product, yet have at the same point a similarly discounted price point. It's unsustainable, and we look at Aldi, at least on this show, as one of the most efficient retailers. And look, yeah, you're not going to get customer service in an Aldi, but you're going to get the lowest possible price point from them as a result of not only their economies of scale, because they have grown so large here in the United States, but also because of that private label selection that Aldi has become famous for. And even with better overall service and fairly good prices, customers are only now beginning to take to the model. Same store sales reportedly up with some locations, but that still doesn't explain the locations that they're not filling right now, which is what this lawsuit is all about.
Some think that Lidl will be able to get over this hump, both with ironing out the operational issues and the pending North Carolina lawsuit. But what some fail to mention is the potential of a new wave of litigation coming by way of other states that saw new development stymied. There are some long-term consequences that we finally want to get into with this story, and this is yet another aspect that no one seems to be discussing. In commercial real estate, long-term tenants are key for good income valuation, especially for those REITs that are interested in buy and hold properties. What is even better is if developers can sign contracts with national credit tenants with corporate guarantees. Given the relative size of Lidl in Europe, it was a no-brainer for many of these East Coast developers to want to work with Lidl on land development and to get the zoning and permit processes going sooner than later. With this apparent pullout in a number of different markets, you have to question the level of hesitancy that anyone is going to have moving forward, including landowners and brokers representing current landowners, as they move forward with any future proposals if Lidl does in fact continue to build out their store portfolio here in the United States. As a result, contracts are probably going to have a bit stronger language built in and clauses that make Lidl and its parent company pay potentially heightened fees for pulling out of an arrangement altogether, like they have here allegedly in some circumstances. Not only that, purchase prices could be a bit less negotiable, and Lidl looks to continued expansion over the next few years, they may be having to pay a little bit higher prices in every way during the process because people are worried about their history. If a developer has a couple of different options for a parcel of land, for instance, they may be more willing and more flexible on the land use and purchase price with someone if the only other interested party is Lidl.
It's kind of a fool me once, shame on you, fool me twice, shame on me type of a situation with Lidl here. And you mentioned developers want national credit tenants, but if they're deciding between two tenants and one of them is Lidl, they're probably going to go with the other one at this point, given this track record, especially with larger REITs. So they might find themselves dealing with local landowners or smaller brokers or developers as a result in the future. It's very difficult for a business to come back from something like this, and it takes years to build up your reputation after you've left people at the altar in this manner. So not only will we be looking ahead to the outcome of this lawsuit, but as Leighton mentioned, we're very interested to see if any more of these lawsuits come forward and impact Lidl in this way. Well, coming up after the music, we'll be joined by Javi Lieber. She's a senior reporter at RACT, has also written for the New York Times, among other outlets, and she'll be joining us to discuss the impact of Kate Spade, who died last week, on the fashion retail industry. Well, it was last week that the fashion world got a big shock in hearing that Kate Spade died in circumstances that we'll end up actually discussing on this very interview. But here to join us to talk a little bit about Kate Spade's legacy, not so much the event itself last week, but her legacy, how she created her brand, is Javi Lieber. She covers fashion, retail, and business for RACT. She's a senior reporter at that very media outlet. Award-winning reporter, in fact, graduate of the Columbia Journalism School. Her work has appeared in the New York Times, New York Magazine, The Daily Beast, and the Jerusalem Post. And I know, Javi, you've covered Kate Spade a lot during the course of your journalism career. Thank you so much for joining us today on the Retail Focus podcast.
Sure. Thank you for having me, although I was wishing we were able to chat under better news and circumstances.
Absolutely. So we'll start with this. Once the news started trickling out, and I know it was something that you caught us by surprise, what was the general reaction like from the fashion world, and particularly from the fashion retail world?
I think people were really shocked. The last we had heard from Kate Spade, the person, she was pushing her new brand, Frances Valentine, and was really, really excited about making a comeback into fashion. RACT had interviewed her last year, and she had talked about how she had left Kate Spade and decided to move on from the brand and was a stay-at-home mom and was itching and sort of like, you know, wishing to jump back into the designer space and was pushing these new ideas for, you know, fluffy furry shoes and colorful handbags under Frances Valentine. And, you know, people were just really, really surprised, shocked, and saddened by the news. But again, I think this really speaks to the severity of depression and mental illness, you know, a lot of the times, and frankly, most of the time, you don't really know what's going on somebody's, you know, inner circles and in their life, no matter how colorful the accessories or handbags are that they're designing.
So I want to go back to the beginning of her career, and I think her genesis story, so to speak, is fairly interesting. It's kind of that, you don't want to say rags to riches story, because I think that might be mischaracterizing it a little bit, but it is quite literally someone takes bags to a fashion show and gets signed to a number of major retailers within the span of months. How remarkable was her success story, and is it something that in today's day and age, being that we're not in the early 90s anymore, is replicable maybe by a future fashion brand?
Yeah, Kate Spade's success story, you know, the initial part of how she started her brand definitely could not be replicated today. You know, she is a Midwesterner. She met her husband and business partner at Arizona State and grew up in Kansas City. And she was living in New York City and working as a magazine editor, but was also kind of, she's told publications she was bored of the job and, you know, the different accessories that were on the market. And so she started making, you know, silhouettes of bags that she thought was fun. So she was quite literally cutting, pasting, using tape and scissors to make little, I guess, replicas of bags that she thought were fun and unique. I think it's important to look at the classic handbags that were selling at the time. You had, you know, Chanel and Prada, also Coach and Longchamp. Those bags, you know, they were brown, they were leather, they were black. They weren't really very exciting. And because Kate Spade was a Kansas City native, she had a really fun and unique, some would say eccentric type of fashion aesthetic. She liked bright colors. She liked fun shapes. She even, I read a quote where she said she, you know, would often think about her mother's closet and vintage shops with lots of bags that had pearls and big gemstones. So really just different from that classic black and brown leather handbag type of space. And what happened was she went to trade shows with her bags. And they were pretty different from what was out there. You know, the bags were nylon and all different types of colors. And right away, she got picked up by Barney's and Fred Siegel. Also, a boutique that was really popular in the 80s and 90s called Charivari, which is the same boutique that kickstarted Marc Jacobs' career and also Isaac Mizrahi's career. And it used to be a big fashion player. From there, a few months later, Bloomingdale's, Nordstrom, and Saks all started carrying the Kate Spade company. And pretty soon, you know, the handbags were just seen all over New York City. You had Anna Wintour and Linda Wells carrying them, Julia Roberts, Gwyneth Paltrow, and the bags eventually spread from A-list and celebrities to, I guess, what you would call your upper middle class shopper. They were by no means cheap. I think they averaged at about $300. You know, the smaller ones went for $150, the bigger ones went for $400. But again, she was targeting this upper middle class shopper who wasn't really interested in spending, you know, a few thousand dollars on a Louis Vuitton or a Chanel or Prada bag, but still wanted a cool designer bag. And Kate Spade really offered something unique, colorful, and different.
Not only the colorful aspect of it, but also the price point. In what ways did she kind of revolutionize the way not only those that make bags, but those that make other products revolutionize the way they targeted that upper middle class or even middle class shopper with these goods?
Yeah, if you look at the sector today, I guess the industry term would be affordable luxury. Now you have huge billion-dollar companies, Kate Spade included, but also Michael Kors and Coach. You know, they are billion-dollar brands, and they sell handbags, they sell clothes, they sell shoes. And it is this midpoint price that is not crazy expensive. I don't want to say that I think that the word affordable is frankly dishonest and unfair, but it is the type of luxury that you could save up some money to buy. I was on the Kate Spade and the Frances Valentine Instagram after Kate passed away, looking at comments, and people were saying how, you know, it was their first designer bag. It was their something that they got for their bat mitzvah. It was something that they saved up their babysitting money to buy. So it was, in many ways, for a lot of people, sort of this entryway into the fashion and designer world. And she really paved the way for this type of product where, you know, again, you're not spending thousands of dollars, but you are able to drop $400. It is a significant amount of money, but then you have a small piece of this, you know, seemingly otherwise unattainable world.
Now, something I think a lot of people might not have realized up until maybe the last week, as it was more publicized in the news and that type of thing, was that she had stepped away from the main Kate Spade brand, as you referenced, to become a mother, to focus on family. But yet that brand still had this remarkable staying power, even though she wasn't the one spearheading a lot of the brand's efforts. To what extent did she have a hand in kind of building up the brand so that it could basically live on its own and become its own identity?
Kate was very involved in building the Kate Spade empire from being just handbags to essentially becoming this huge lifestyle company. You know, she had this really unique and specific type of personality. She was really into design and etiquette and hosting. The Washington Post in the early aughts, they described her style as preppy with attitude. And the Kate Spade brand eventually was going from just handbags to other categories. They had fine china, they had picture frames, linens, towels, and eventually she also wrote books on style and decorating. And Kate eventually became this sort of tastemaker. And so when she sold the brand in 2006 and left the company eventually, the company was able to sort of almost personify her as this character, even though she wasn't with the company. I did some reporting on the Kate Spade brand in 2016 for a long form story on the Kate Spade empire. And a lot of shoppers didn't even know that she wasn't with the company. You know, they'd walk into a store and say, oh, Kate Spade, she has really good style. I love her shoes. I love her clothing. But Kate Spade, the person, didn't start clothing herself while she was at the company. A lot of the credit should go to the company's former creative director, Deborah Lloyd, who sort of honored Kate Spade, the person's lifestyle of and desire to live colorfully, as the brand loves to say, but also sort of take on this persona of playfulness and whim and start to craft this narrative that the brand is for colorful, interesting, fun-loving women of all ages. It should be noted, Kate Spade, the brand, it's really unique in that, you know, teenagers love the company, house moms love the company. It really just defies an age demographic.
I want to get back to those descriptors you just used, colorful, interesting, fun-loving, and that seems now that we have some details, and I know you wrote in your article last week in Racked about some of these details, where she was battling with depression over the last 3 to 4 years, but also didn't maybe want to seek help because it would erase some of her brand standing. Is there this disconnect sometimes in the fashion world? Is there this pressure to make sure that basically you're putting this emotional labor, you're putting up this front, and you've got to maintain that brand image that might prevent people from maybe seeking help or really finding themselves in that way?
It should come as a surprise to no one that the pressure from jobs, from high stakes jobs, really get to people. I was just looking into coverage and sort of, you know, research on what happened when Alexander McQueen took his own life. And, you know, the pressures are certainly there. I can't speak to what the former fashion designer was going through. I do know that her family had said that she seemed happy and, you know, was looking into getting help. And, you know, it's just, it's really, really tragic that she wasn't able to get the help that she needed.
I know forecasting the future can sometimes be a bit of a fool's errand, but if we look 50, 100 years even in the future, what's going to be the prevailing thought regarding the brand and how Kate Spade revolutionized how we look at fashion retail?
50 to 100 years is pretty far in the future. I will say, you know, now and forever, I think fans will really just credit her for the ability to bring fun, style, and color into a world that really favors neutral minimalism. You know, you look at the fashion industry, particularly in New York. I mean, everybody, it's a joke at times, but it is true. You know, people love black. People love the minimalist, what some people call normcore look. And Kate Spade, she brought her fun and flair to fashion. And I think it's also worth noting that she showed women of all ages that you could bring a little color and fun into your life. You know, just because you were in the suburbs, you know, a mom with many kids, didn't mean that you couldn't have a hot pink or a hot green bag. She really showed that with the success of her brand and with the ongoing efforts to just bring a little bit of flavor and whimsy into fashion design.
Who are some present day designers, manufacturers who either list Kate Spade as influences or maybe implicitly have an influence based in Kate Spade?
Initially, when I was doing research, my editor was like, oh, you know, the nut for this should be that she invented affordable luxury. But if you look at the time frame, Coach was around the same time that she was, and Michael Kors and Marc Jacobs were also kind of defining their career at the same time. I think that she was a bit more interesting than Michael Kors or Marc Jacobs. Her designs were way more fun. She had way more patterns, a lot more color. And again, I think people also really resonated with her and the brand because, first of all, she's a woman. Unfortunately, you don't really hear these type of success stories, especially with women above the age of, I don't know, whatever age corporate America decides that you are no longer valid. And, you know, it's really a testament to her hard work. I remember reading about how her and her husband, Andy, they drained his 401k at a certain point. You know, they were really, you know, going at it, working really hard. And it's just so different than these huge fashion brands now that start off and they get hundreds of millions of dollars of VC funding.
Javi Lieber, once again, senior reporter at RAC, discussing the impact and the lasting legacy of Kate Spade. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Retail Focus podcast.
Sure. Thanks so much for having me.
We move on to the food and beverage and entertainment industry. This with Dave & Buster's, as they failed to provide any real traction during their latest quarter, but the food and entertainment concept is still optimistic about the future, and so are their shareholders, apparently. New openings help boost revenue by over 9.2%, but existing restaurants, if that's what we want to call them, saw comps decline. Analysts, after all, were expecting issues with same restaurant sales. Those did decline by 4.9% year over year, but that did beat those Wall Street expectations that were somewhat tepid, coming in around negative 5.6%. Revenue rose to $332 million from $304 million last year. Analysts had expected earnings per share of around 94 cents on revenue of around $321 million. So you can see that they did beat by $11 million on that top line figure. We look towards that earnings per share figure and see that they beat there as well by around 5 cents per share. So adjusted earnings per share came in around 98 cents. While earnings per share was higher, they are necessarily not as productive or efficient from the bottom line perspective if you dig deeper into the numbers. Dave & Buster's had adjusted EBITDA for this quarter that was 28.9% of revenue versus 31.4% a year ago. That trickled down as well to operating income, which was down also as a percentage of sales. The big headline maker for the company was driven by their current CEO, Stephen King, who announced he's retiring by the end of the second quarter, succeeded by their CFO, their current CFO, Brian Jenkins. King, however, will remain on the board as chairman. This was not just news because of this big leadership turnover, but many feel that Brian Jenkins is actually going to be the right person to make the company have positive quarters going forward. More quarters that are seeing positive headlines like this latest quarter. Before Dave & Buster's, Jenkins, for reference, was a senior vice president at Six Flags, which they may know a thing or two about the gaming and entertainment industry. He had worked there for the better part of a decade before joining the leadership team there at Dave & Buster's. As for Stephen King, he made it known on the conference call towards the end of his remarks that he will continue to be emotionally and financially attached to the company while he works on the board seat. So he's not going anywhere anytime soon. And he said that he is devoted to the company and he feels passionately about the company's future.
Now, despite these leadership changes at the top, they're still looking to add as many locations as previously outlined. While the runway for growth may not be as large as they once expected, they still want to open between 14 to 15 new stores this year. This would represent 13 to 14% unit growth. Openings include 11 large, 2 small, and 2 medium-sized, or 17,000 square foot format stores, and will skew towards new or newer markets for the chain. For current locations or locations open at least a year for the remainder of this fiscal year, they're looking at same store sales declines or same restaurant sales declines or same entertainment center declines, if you so wish, that are pretty much in line with this first quarter report. Management expects comps to decrease low to mid single digits in terms of percentage points. However, fewer gambling on the success of their new CEO appointment at the end of the second quarter. The company may be up for a quick turnaround, could potentially see neutral comps. I don't think we're looking necessarily for the neutral comps. I'm thinking low single digits, and I think Leighton is basically along the same lines. They did let it be known, though, that they're looking at 2018 is a recalibration of sorts, so actual comps could come in even worse than their guidance suggests. Here, they're just kind of hedging their bets on the call. Now, let's talk about games, food, and beverage. For the first quarter, they did see success in a few new games. Tomb Raider and Rampage, for example, did well during the quarter. They're actually in the midst of rolling out their first proprietary VR title, which is Jurassic World VR Expedition. And VR is something that could do the company some good if done right, but maybe a friction point also to overcome, as setting individuals up with the VR sets can take time, it can take staff, and we also have to recognize the fact that VR could make it less of a multiplayer game as well, potentially. Not necessarily fully the case, especially once it's adopted in all of their Dave & Buster's locations, but they still want a robust VR portfolio of content going forward at all of their locations. Another future release that's non-VR will be a limited time collaboration with Microsoft for a Halo game. Now, in terms of food and beverage, leadership teams have really been focused on this. Last year, they spoke of simplification across the board, and now, Layton, it's turned to quality and accessibility.
They are pleased with the success of a new burger that seems to be a little bit more quality-oriented, and they will be trying to carry out some of that momentum into what they called a new steak and chicken offering later on for the second half of the year. And they went into a bit of detail when talking about the accessibility, because when we talk about the food industry or food service industry, accessibility could mean a number of things. And so it was important that we read the comments there that the management had in regards to that facet. They want to quickly have options available. This means they want to have fast casual type options for the customers coming in and just wanting to play the games, that don't want to necessarily sit at the bar for long periods of time or sit at a table waiting with their family to be served. They want to have things take less than 15 to 20 minutes, essentially. They want people to have different options, a different variety of food options that aren't necessarily entree-based. Their current CEO, Stephen King, said that improving service and reducing friction in the guest experience is also a strategic priority for them, and they're focused more on attention and pain points at the front desk, at their bars, in the dining room, and while purchasing power cards and activating games. And I think this is very important to note, because you and I, Trent, have both visited Dave & Buster's in the recent past, and if you go into a location, it is sort of obvious that they have a lot of opportunity in terms of the guest experience, because if you're new to a Dave & Buster's, you go in, you see a bar, you see games off to the side, you see a dining area, an event center, you don't even know what's happening. But in order to make a clear message stated to their core customer, or potentially their future core customer, these types of things, these friction points, as the CEO put it, have to be ironed out for the long term. So I think their initiatives, their type of initiatives, are going to be judged by how well they execute them in the next year. So obviously for us, from our perspective, that was the number one thing for Dave & Buster's, is to have very quick appetizer options for those people that just want to come in, potentially drink and play with some games for 45 minutes to an hour and a half. They don't have time to sit and wait for 20 to 25 minutes for an appetizer to come to your table and then get up after you're done eating and after you're done interfacing with the waitress to then play the games and have fun with your power cards and what have you. So I officially think this is a good route for the company. But again, it's going to be all about execution and how the current CEO, Stephen King, hands the leadership reins down to the current CFO. Only time will tell if these customer-centric initiatives really do pan out. But as far as it goes for now, shareholders seem to believe they will. Shares shot up 15% on Tuesday from around $47 a share on Monday to $54 a share. It has been an up and down sort of year for the food and entertainment chain, with those shares swaying back and forth. 1 year ago, shares were over $67. And so you can see that if you're a current shareholder, there is still room to grow if you are patient and have faith in their unit growth and their overall operations improvement.
Well, we hit our final story and we turn to Cardlytics. Again, data research firm Cardlytics. Let's give you a little bit of a backdrop on, again, where they get this data from. Cardlytics is a backer of a number of cashback or rewards programs for credit cards. As a result of this, they can mine data, and it's kind of across the board. They can mine data from a lot of different retailers. They can mine data from a lot of different card companies. The result is billions of data points for them to come out with some very interesting research with. And this week, they came out with research regarding back-to-school sales. Now, sales here in this space, always ultra-competitive. Brick-and-mortar retailers will try to pile up inventory right about this time of year, if not a little bit earlier. And they're starting to make some of their walkways a destination for school supplies. You're going to see it more across the country over the next couple of weeks. And so there's a lot of interesting things going on with back-to-school sales. Well, for one, you've got Prime Day. And in 2017, according to Cardlytics data, Prime Day's deals encouraged a lot of customers to actually get a head start and shop earlier on back-to-school shopping. Those that shopped on Prime Day were also big spenders on every channel. So it wasn't just Amazon where they were buying their goods. They spent up to 23% more than customers that didn't take advantage of Prime Day in that back-to-school time, making them an important target audience for all retailers as well. We talk about this creep with back-to-school sales creeping earlier and earlier every year, just like Christmas sales seemingly creeping earlier and earlier. It's referenced a lot in pop culture. Well, it turns out that it's honestly a good thing to target those early shoppers. Online shoppers often fill their basket up throughout the year. They hold off on making a purchase until a major sale occurs, leading to bigger online baskets this time of year. So they're thinking ahead, particularly for those big market items. For example, things like backpacks, not necessarily your crayons, your pencils, and all of that. Still, though, this last year in 2017, 73.3% of back-to-school shoppers made their purchases exclusively in store in 2017. This is not to say that 73.3% of purchases were made in store. This says 73.3% of back-to-school shoppers made their purchases exclusively in store, meaning they didn't participate in e-commerce during the back-to-school stretch. Now, these consumers still prefer digital deals over physical coupons, as it turns out, even though they're just spending money in store. But at the same time, I think that helps to kind of keep things in perspective, despite the fact that traditional brick and mortars are falling back a little bit in terms of back to school sales. And one of the other things of note in this study, since 2015, more consumers are shopping online. Fewer have been shopping in store only for back to school. But still, traditional brick and mortars did rake in the majority of the back to school spend.
The total back to school shopping trips from 2015 to 2017 have actually decreased by almost half. However, the spend per trip has actually been consistently growing across all three channels, brick and mortar and online only. If we look at some of the insights from Cardlytics along with their suggestions for retailers, we see that Amazon Prime Day shoppers spend over 3 times more online in the week following Prime Day than non-Prime Day shoppers. That sort of makes sense. A suggestion there would be following Prime Day, e-commerce merchants should actually potentially target Prime Day shoppers heavily. Non-Prime Day shoppers spend more at brick and mortar stores in the week following Prime Day than Prime Day shoppers do. Again, there you can see that brick and mortar should maybe focus heavily on non-Prime Day shoppers during the week after Prime Day. There are multiple tricks of the trade in terms of marketing those particular shoppers, but you need them into your stores if indeed there is still a market to be had for these types of sales. And last year, overall brick and mortar back to school spend was pulled forward by nearly a month due to Prime Day shopping, and this proved to be a smart tactic by Amazon. In 2017, brickandmortar.com sales ended up staying flat for back to school versus decreasing as they had in previous years. You can see that retailers should maybe pull forward their back to school campaigns to effectively compete with Amazon Prime Day. As a result, online shoppers often fill their basket throughout the year and hold off on making a purchase until a major sale occurs. You can see that retailers should maybe launch teaser campaigns in order to encourage back-to-school shoppers to get a head start on filling up their baskets. It's important for merchants to stay top of mind all year round with their promotions. Overall, you can see that strengthening brand loyalty by running post-back-to-school campaigns is actually going to get consumers into the habit of choosing your brand first. So a lot of insights there if you're a retailer that listens to this podcast potentially, but a lot of interesting insights. I remember the back to school sales back when I was in elementary school, middle school, high school, and it would always bum me out that they happened to occur at such an early time frame. And last year we had actually talked about on the podcast how the different tactics end up working for retailers like Target and Walmart, even though you have to do some deep discounting once all of that inventory has not sold after the back-to-school season has ended.
As always, we may have a position in or against companies we discuss on the podcast. Do not invest in stocks solely on the input of the podcast hosts.
Well, we've reached the final segment of the Retail Focus podcast, where each Layton and I take a look ahead at a story that we'll be keeping an eye on for the next week or the next month. And Layton, as he did with the Dave and Buster story, he's going back to food.
I'm going back to pizza, in fact, as they are looking to fill potholes in certain winning communities, or at least communities that have the most robust presence of wanting potholes filled. The company is already actually working with local governments in a number of different areas in Texas, Delaware, Georgia, and Burbank, California to repair roads, filling potholes and stamping those potholes, those repaired potholes, with a Domino's logo. And yes, you heard correctly. The cities are allowing Domino's to fill potholes in designated areas and then stamp their own logo on the pothole because they themselves have decided to not do it. If you look at a statement through Domino's president of their USA division, they said that they want any great tasting pizza to not get burned by a pothole ruining a wonderful meal. And they said that they care too much about its customers and their pizza to let that happen. Customers can actually nominate their town for a paving grant from Domino's website, pavingforpizza.com. Again, that's pavingforpizza.com. You can enter in your city's information, and Domino's is going to select a town versus the demand for that given vicinity, and the customer will be notified if the government will receive the funds to repair the roads. But again, this is an interesting initiative by Domino's because this is sort of a win-win here because you're stamping out roads with your logo. So one could look at that as sort of an advertising ploy, but also the larger PR extent of it to where podcasters like us or maybe mainstream news outlets, either on TV or the internet, are talking about how interesting this is. And then also it turns into a political discussion where Domino's is at the forefront of everyone's mind, basically saying that, oh, well, maybe the government needs more funds to repair roads, or maybe it does need to be privatized. So regardless, I think the winner is going to be Domino's in this particular circumstance. It's certainly something that is going to be a clean marketing tactic, something new and innovative that maybe you'll see other companies filling potholes down the line.
Well, my looking ahead story heads to the Pacific Northwest, where just this week we talked about the head tax that was passed by the City Council of Seattle about a month ago. Well, that got rescinded at a meeting on Tuesday. And not only did the city backtrack on that head tax, which basically, to sum it all up, charged employers $275 for each full-time employee they had on staff when employers hit a certain revenue level. That's been rolled back. And I think the interesting thing for me is a lot of people characterizing this is certainly blaming Amazon, blaming the big corporations, Starbucks and other, and the big corporations winning in this circumstance. But what a lot of people that are on the outside looking in haven't really realized about this head tax debate is there's a lot of other retailers, as we discussed on this very show about a month ago, or maybe a little over a month ago, that stood to be negatively impacted from this head tax. And we're not even talking Amazon. Even small area grocery stores, for example, a citation was made in the Seattle Times of a Japanese grocery there in the Seattle area that's based in the Seattle area having to pay this very same head tax. And we talk about grocery stores, they're not necessarily high income businesses, but they are high revenue businesses. So most of the grocery stores in this area got up to that revenue threshold to where they would have to be paying for their full-time employees. So the worry there was either that grocers were going to have to shut down or maybe have a few fewer employees. Well, it's interesting because the council actually asked about this, and they never had an answer in terms of taxing grocery stores. I think they were so focused on Amazon and Starbucks and some of the bigger companies paying this head tax. But in the end, this turns out to be a victory for retailers, whether they are enormous like Amazon or whether they're a smaller regional grocer up there. And it's probably a win in terms of not creating food deserts in Seattle, which would actually run askew to what they're trying to do, which is fix a homelessness and poverty problem there in the city. But when all is said and done, they'll probably find some way to maybe put the proposal back on the table again. If they're so worried about Starbucks and Amazon, an onlooker might ask, why don't you just assess an Amazon tax and be done with it? But very interesting. A lot of differing opinions on this particular tax in Seattle. There have been a lot of hot takes throughout the country, but the bottom line is, it turns out that this week's ruling, a good thing for grocers at the very least going forward that have a stake in the Pacific Northwest. Well, that'll do it for Leighton and I here on the Retail Focus Podcast. Remember, check us out at Retail Podcast on Twitter or Instagram during the week. We'll be back 1 week from now with another interview and another show.
This has been the Retail Focus Podcast. For more, visit our website at retailfocuspodcast.com and subscribe on iTunes or Stitcher. Follow us on Twitter at Retail Podcast.